It is a great pleasure to welcome you to Manchester and avoid the usual joke on the rain and so on, because it's a beautiful day, and which it always is actually in autumn. I find that when I'm asked to introduce conferences, this is the bit that people are thinking, oh God, can he move on to the talks, because we don't really want this funny old chap talking about things and so on. But what I've found is every time I've had to do this, I have found, and I suspect this is just getting old, is that there is some link to my own history and story in terms of what the conference is doing. Although I must admit I had to work quite hard when I did the conference on supersymmetry, basically. So I must admit that I'm a particle physicist, an experimental particle physicist. And so you may wonder, well, what the hell can I be linked to dilution refrigerators and so on? Well, actually, the answer is in the program, because you can see that there's someone here from CERN. Tapio, you're out there somewhere, who actually, he and I have actually worked together at some level in a collaboration many years ago. So it's very nice to see him here. So it is fantastic to talk about this and the 50 years of the dilution refrigerator, and to acknowledge that this is organized jointly by the University of Manchester and the IOP groups of the history of physics and low temperature physics. I'm not gonna get into who invented it, okay? So the you guys can discuss that. Which one is it? Is it this one here, isn't it? So I ought to also acknowledge all the various sponsors, and I think this slide actually illustrates that this, what seems to be rather an arcane physics innovation, actually is really very important, and it has spectacular impact in the real world, and there are very many companies out there making a whole pile of money as a result of this invention, basically. So anyone of you who knows about the REF exercise in the UK, we couldn't use this as an impact case, because unfortunately it was slightly outside the census period, but it was a great pity, because there's no doubt at all that this technology has been absolutely transformative, basically, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that in your various talks. And certainly as a particle physicist, you can't imagine particle physics without the LHC, and that's a very large refrigerator, basically. So what's the link to me? Well, the answer is it goes right back to my PhD. And this is my PhD experiment that measured the polarization in kaon neutron scattering at, remember, we were called high-energy physicists in those days, so 1 GeV was high energy. So, of course, if you're into electron volts, then I suppose GeV is quite high. Now, in this experiment, of course, the trick is the polarization. Basically, what you're trying to do is to see how the scattering alters as you change the spin of the target neutron, okay, whether it's pointing basically up or down in a magnet. And of course the problem then is, well, how the hell do you get polarized neutrons? Now, what I'm showing you here is actually the experiment when it had the spark chambers put around the target, so you can't actually see the target. It's not all wired up and so on, but I believe that those were the very last spark chambers ever used in a particle physics experiment. Thank God, because there are bloody awful things. So here actually is the polarized target and the magnet the year before. And this is how I saw it when I started as a PhD student. And I remember being taken down to this beam line and thinking, bloody hell, that's enormous, because of course I was only used to experiments that were sitting on a bench at that point, and I couldn't imagine that anyone would want to build an experiment any bigger than could be fitted on a bench, basically. And the other thing that I was very worried about is there were 15 people working on this experiment, okay? And of course the irony now is that there's now 4,000 people working on particle physics experiments, and so I'd love to go back to the days when there were only 15 people on a single experiment. So is there a pointer on this thing? Presumably there is. So it's that one, isn't it? Yeah. So in fact, you can see the, I can't remember the name of the technician here, but you can see the polarized target pointing, and this is the magnet there, and so on. And then all this stuff here is associated with the polarised targets. And so I think this was this had cost something like £1 or 2 million in 1975. So this was quite an investment, and so on. I should say, by the way, that the real guru was a guy called Steve Cox, who was probably only a few years older than me, and he was an absolute whiz on this target and so on. Find the next slide. So this is what it looks like in cross-section. And so you see the magnet, and you can see the bits of the cryostat coming in, and the bit that pokes in, so there's the vacuum vessel there, pokes into the magnet. So this could cool down a target that was 49 cubic centimetres down to 0.4 Kelvin. Okay, that's bloody amazing. The other thing that really amazes me is that this is 1975. This is only 10 years after the very first little one that was built and tested and so on. The fact that the technology got to the point where you could build something like this. Although I'm now reliably informed, learning over tea from Tapio, that they stole the design from CERN. So he's going to actually tell you how this works, because I must admit, as a PhD student, I never really understood how this thing worked as a cryostat. So I'm going to leave that for Tapio to explain. Keep wanting to push the wrong button. So essentially, the thing that I found most amazing about this was how it worked. And I've been forever grateful to Steve Cox for explaining to me how it worked. So essentially, you start off with a 2.5 Tesla magnetic field. You cool it down to 0.4 Kelvin, which is not trivial at all. This polarizes the electrons to 99.7%. Unfortunately, it only polarizes the protons to 0.5%. And of course, the deuterons hardly at all. But the real trick is this, is that you have the energy levels here. And if they're thermally at 0.4 Kelvin, then they're arranged according to Fermi-Dirac statistics in a particular way for that particular temperature. But if you're very clever, if you get yourself a 70 gigahertz microwave signal, you can pump that in and you can effectively move electrons from here to there and effectively change the temperature of the electron bath. And since this is then coupled to the protons and the deuterons in the target, so we didn't have free neutrons, then in fact you can then effectively, because they're thermally coupled, end up with protons at 93% from 0.5% and deuterons at 36%. Don't you think that's amazing? I think that's bloody amazing. So the other thing you can do is, of course, since you're pumping in this, you effectively can get a nuclear magnetic resonance signal, which is shown over here. And this one here, which is for the deuteron, this is what it would look like if these two peaks would be equal height if they were not polarized. But because they're polarized, you've effectively got one, the ones in the up state are effectively more likely than the ones in the other state. And so in fact, you could see this actually on the experiment, because there was an oscilloscope, and on the screen you could see this signal. And actually, this was the first time I believed in quantum mechanics when I saw that. So I really thought that was bloody amazing. And the thing that I've never really understood is, I think if I'd seen all this stuff before I became a particle physicist, I think I might have switched field, basically. So, because it's actually absolutely fascinating stuff, basically. So that's my link to dilution fridges and their uses. The other one is my link to Henry Hall himself. And so, of course, unfortunately, I have to admit that I am not a Manchester person myself. I'm a southerner, and was educated in London and spent almost all of my career in London. And my first exercise in condensed matter physics was from the Manchester series Properties of Matter by Flowers and Mendoza. I don't know how many people have been excited by this book. I doubt very many. I can tell you, can someone please rewrite this book? Because this is what put me off condensed matter physics. I'm glad that Flowers and Mendoza are not in the audience. I know that it's a real pity, because condensed matter is such an exciting field, and you have to start off here, and it isn't. I never found this particularly exciting. However, I've discovered in life that if you avoid something, it comes back and bites you. And so, in fact, as a result of this, I avoided all the condensed matter courses as an undergraduate by careful choice of units. You could do that in those days. And then I became a lecturer. And what did they give me to do as my first course? A course on solid-state physics, of course, because, of course, I hadn't studied it at all. And I must admit that one of the best books on this is by Henry Hall and J.R. Hooke, basically. So all I can say is thank you, Henry Hall, for that. And so, of course, Henry Hall is linked to the cryostat because he's one of the people who built one of the first ones. So that's enough from me, because you want to get on to the real stuff. But thank you for coming to Manchester. I know a lot of you have come from far away. And it is a landmark meeting. You know, 50 years, it's really amazing. In fact, you can see bits of the original cryostats here. I don't know whether Andre's dug them out. It's rather sad that they were pinned to a wall down in the basement. They're actually really very important pieces of scientific equipment that probably deserve a bit better looking after. And I'm going to briefly say thank you to the organizing committee, but I'm sure that Andre at the end will go through and do that in more detail. And please enjoy the meeting and enjoy the talks and celebrate this wonderful landmark.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve.